All right, y'all. Welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. You guys watching C-SPAN right now? They got General Alexander and Mike Connell up there perjuring themselves. It's a great time. One thing that might be interesting to some of y'all is Dianne Feinstein just talked about how 3 months before 9/11, George Tenet, who is then not just the head of the CIA, but the director of Central Intelligence, which means he was the boss of all the intelligence agencies, came to her and said, there's going to be an Al-Qaeda attack in the next 3 months, I think. And according to her, he couldn't say where or when or how. But he just knew it was true. And then she goes on to say, oh my God, and then the thing happened. And remember how bad it was? And that's why we need the NSA spying program now. Well, never mind what journalist James Bamford showed about what the NSA knew before 9/11 and what they could have done to prevent it. Doesn't matter to her. She says, quote, they couldn't collect enough data. Oh, that is such a lie. But to me, it opens up a whole new group of questions, right? She even says she ordered her staff, and they went back and found a press release that she put out, that her office put out in the summer of 2001, after the briefing by George Tenet, saying, we think an attack might come soon, which she cited. So then my question is, you know, we're all used to wondering, if we haven't already leaped to our conclusions, why George Bush was doing such a lousy job preventing Al-Qaeda attacks in the country when he'd only been the president for 9 months already. He'd only been told by the outgoing president, hey, listen, if there's one thing you got to be worried about, it's these Al-Qaeda guys. 9 months before. But what about Dianne Feinstein? And what about the responsibility of those in Congress who had been briefed by George Tenet? We all know this is around the same time John Ashcroft started flying private jets, the attorney general at the time, former senator, who had just lost an election to a dead man, which is why he was made attorney general. Anyway, so did Dianne Feinstein call a hearing immediately of the FBI counterintelligence guys, or even a meeting with the head of the FBI counterintelligence guys? And did she question them? Hey, is it true that there's some real Al-Qaeda dudes in the country? Where are they? Who are they? What are you doing about it? She had at least 3 months to, as the bureaucrats like to say, shake the trees. And you know what? This does work too. This is what happened at the Millennium. At the Millennium, I guess it was Al Gore, maybe some others. They called a couple of meetings with the heads of all the domestic police agencies. And they said, hey man, we are serious as a heart attack about this Al-Qaeda thing. We want everybody to double check everything and keep your eyes, keep your scanners peeled, dude. Everybody be on the lookout. And word of that had trickled all the way down to the border security guard at the Canadian border, who walked up on a car with a sweating Arab in it and said, hi, Mr. Sweating Arab, would you mind popping your trunk for me? And went and found explosives and a map to LAX in his trunk. And I forget the entire story behind that guy, but he was a bin Ladenite. He was a real-ass Al-Qaeda dude sent to try to blow up LAX at the Millennium. And that was because somebody was taking their job seriously in D.C., that they were, you know, figuratively slapping awake every low-level cop, every low-level federal cop, and saying, hey, seriously, be on the lookout for this. Well, so anyway, we all know that George Bush should be strung up for that attack happening on his watch. Or how about, you know, George Tenet and then see what truths he squeals before the gallows trapdoor is pulled out from under him. I would like to hear it. I would like to see what he and Condoleezza Rice have to say. Anyway, never mind that. What about Dianne Feinstein, who just admitted that she was warned by the DCI that there was going to be an attack? When she is, at least, I don't know what her position was exactly then. Let's see, that would have been after Jeffords switched to the Democrats, so she may well have been the chairman of the Intelligence Committee at the time. Right? Was it Jeffers? Is that the guy's name? The kind of Rockefeller Republican who switched to the Democrats in the spring of 01 and made the Democrats the majority party in the U.S. Senate? Dianne Feinstein has the blood of 3,000 dead innocents on her hands, it sounds like to me. Or is it not her responsibility? Somebody else's responsibility? Louis Freeh, perhaps? Oh, you know what? How about it's nobody's responsibility? Oh, except every innocent Arab between Jordan and Pakistan. Or Muslim between Jordan and Pakistan. Right? We've got to be very, 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 very specific about responsibility on the part of Americans who's watched the attack happened on. We'll be so specific that we can't find anybody to blame at all. Not Donald Rumsfeld, not George Tenet, not Condoleezza Rice, not Dick Cheney. Not the low-level Al-Qaeda analysts in the Alex station. No one at the NSA. In fact, the letters NSA don't even appear in the 9/11 Commission report. There was no NSA on 9/11, I guess. Yeah, it was nobody's fault here in North America. But, hey, if you happen to live from Baghdad to Basra, it doesn't matter that no Iraqis had a single thing to do with that plot whatsoever. We just got to make an example out of you. Yeah. You know, I don't know. It's a funny thing about pain. It could hurt really bad, but you still can't weigh it. You know what I mean? But think about if pain had any kind of weight. Assign whatever density to it or whatever in your imagination. And what if you stacked up all the pain and all the grief of all the Iraqis who suffered? From the American people's, not just the war parties, but the American people's mission to spill more blood because we're not done spilling blood yet. Oh, yeah. We don't care who's responsible or what. Some Egyptians and some Yemenis, some Saudis. Hijack our planes. It's okay to attack Iraq. And kill as many Arabs as we feel like till we feel like we're done. But George Tenet, whose responsibility it actually was to make sure something like that could never happen, why, hey, bygones, bygones. Michael Hayden, he just got promoted, right? He was the head of the NSA at the time, which did in fact exist. And then he ended up being promoted to the head of the CIA. Yeah. It's so funny, too. You know, The Shadow Factory, James Bamford's book about how the 9/11 attack happened on the NSA's watch, on Michael Hayden's watch. It begins with Bamford interviewing Hayden in his office and Hayden pretending, ridiculously claiming, that if Osama bin Laden himself walked across a bridge at some border, I guess, you know, I don't know, from Canada into New York State, at that point he would be a U.S. person and I would not be able to tail him and spy on him anymore. Really, huh? Is that your story and you're sticking to it? Makes me wonder, is it true that there's even a lawyer anywhere in D.C. who ever said that? Or was he just outright lying and turning a blind eye as early as then? Because, of course, the law says if you're an agent of a foreign power, or if they even have an objective, reasonable belief, or perhaps even an articulatable suspicion that one is an agent of a foreign power, then the Fourth Amendment is off. And of course, the NSA and or the FBI's counterintelligence, counterterrorism divisions can search all they want, can surveil all they want. But anyway, no wonder the letters NSA aren't in the 9/11 Commission report anywhere. You know, Michael Scheuer told the story on the show once, as long as we're talking about the National Security Agency and the September 11th attack, and how all they needed was unlimited power and they could have stopped it. Michael Scheuer, he was the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. And I asked him about the National Security Agency on the show before. I forget exactly all of the context, but he told the story, and I think this is in Bamford's book. Maybe he told the story to Bamford, and then I asked him about it, and he told the story again on the show, something like that. Anyway, it goes like this. The 9/11 hijacker, in fact, the one that she just mentioned, one of the guys, was it Hazmi, I think, or Al-Midhar, one of the two, I forget, who from the San Diego cell. One of them, I think Hazmi, his father-in-law, owned the house in Yemen, and you can see the house in Bamford reporting live from out in front of it, or not live, but out from in front of it on the PBS special, the Nova special about this. And that was the switchboard house where these guys took all the calls from Afghanistan and relayed all the messages to all of Bin Laden's groupies wherever they were in the world at the time. And the NSA would not share the intercepts with the CIA. And to hear Michael Scheuer tell it, and you could tell that Michael Scheuer, the guy's angry enough he couldn't possibly be lying. You know what I mean? This is no cover story. He attacked George Tenet viciously and talked about how George Tenet didn't have the moral courage to go over to the air to the NSA and say, no, damn it, I'm the DCI, and I said, give me the intercepts, give me the intercepts. And all the NSA would ever do is drag ass, and all George Tenet would ever do is drag ass and do nothing about it. I'm sorry, that's a Texas roofer term for taking a long lunch break when you're supposed to be working. And so here's what the CIA did. The CIA actually ended up building their own listening station in Madagascar so that they could try to tap the phone of the Yemen switchboard house, because the NSA still wouldn't give them the freaking intercepts. But then, from their own listening station, all they could get was half the conversation. The Yemen half of the conversation, not the Afghanistan half of the conversation. These people should have all been hanged upside down until their heads exploded after September 11th. You know, even though Franklin Delano Roosevelt deliberately set about the 8-point plan in the McCollum memo to deliberately provoke the Pearl Harbor attack and then turn a blind eye to it, still, all the lower down people whose watch it happened on, they were held accountable. And I don't just mean that Kimmel and Short were scapegoated, but others too. Somebody got in trouble for that. But after 9/11, nope, everybody whose fault it was simply got promoted. Right? Like the supervisory special agent at the FBI who refused to let the Minneapolis office follow up on Zacharias Moussaoui. Well, the French gave us a truck full of intelligence that ties him to foreign terrorist groups. Therefore, FISA threshold satisfied. Let's search his papers and records and computer and telephone. And the supervisory special agent said, no, you can't even go to the judge and ask, even though the FISA judges do nothing but wield a rubber stamp, as we all know. They rubber stamp every single thing. That supervisory special agent was promoted. Anyway, all of them. And George Tenet, instead of being hanged, the DCI, they kept him on. They said, we'll keep you on, and we'll leave you blameless for 9/11. As long as you'll take the rap for lying us into war with Iraq. I guess that was a compromise anyway. I don't know. I'm sorry to go off on such a tangent. I'm really not that bad of a truther. I am a bit suspicious that perhaps Cheney and Baker worked with some friends in Saudi Arabia to, you know, help make sure that they got their 15 muscle hijackers at the last minute that they needed and stuff like that. But I'm just making that up. It's just sort of a hunch that the Republicans really wanted this thing to happen, and they deliberately did such a lousy job. However, I don't believe in any of the other 7 million things that truthers believe about that attack whatsoever. So I'm not really, you know, trying to endorse all that stupidity. I think that the Michael Scheuer explanation is perfectly plausible. That these people, virtually all of them, simply lack the moral courage to do their freaking job. Hey, Donald Rumsfeld, we're really worried. Hair's on fire. We're really worried there's going to be an Al-Qaeda attack. And what's Rumsfeld's attitude? Well, I'm not really interested in Al-Qaeda. I want to pick a fight with China. I want to do a missile defense system. In other words, $1 trillion welfare fraud. And you're distracting me with this stupid crap I don't care about. Leave me alone. So let me see. In my imagination, I say, well, they're probably just testing our defenses. Now, maybe that's the modified limited hangout or whatever excuse, but doesn't that sound perfectly plausible to you? That Condoleezza Rice, who knows nothing about nothing, the Russia expert who can't speak Russian, who was a national security advisor at the time, was simply not up to it? She was completely and totally dominated by Dick Cheney and his staff. Even Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, was completely dominated by the Vice President. And how is Condoleezza Rice supposed to do anything about that if Colin Powell couldn't do anything about that? And they were interested in their welfare scams and in picking a fight with China. And I guess, you know, eventually finding a way to bomb Iraq, but it's just as plausible to me. In fact, 2 years ago in the New York Times, a guy wrote on September 11th, 2 years ago, so 2011, wrote a whole thing about how the Republicans were just so obsessed with their little pet issues. And they were just, like Paul O'Neill says, the first Treasury Secretary of the Bush Jr. term, that it was the deaf and stupid leading the blind in that first cabinet meeting. It was absolutely out of control. None of these guys knew anything about anything. They were only there just to get away with whatever they could get away with. He sort of couldn't believe that they were actually in charge of, as he put it, the country. By which he meant the government of the country. Which sort of amounts to the same thing in that context, doesn't it? But anyway, just a fun little tidbit. Sorry for wasting a whole 20 minutes on that. Just a fun little tidbit Condoleezza, right? Dianne Feinstein was warned by George Tenet 3 months in advance that there was an Al-Qaeda attack on this country coming. Not against American interests somewhere. Against this country coming. And then, you tell me, Global Research, or that's not the site, was it, History Commons. You tell me, what did Dianne Feinstein do about it between July and September of 2001? Did she hold any hearings? Did she call the heads of the FBI counterterrorism divisions and ask them what the hell they were doing to find Al-Qaeda in America? Or is 9/11 all Dianne Feinstein's fault too? That's the fun thing about responsibility. It's really more a matter of quality than quantity. So George Tenet can be 100% responsible. Dianne Feinstein can be 100% responsible. George W. Bush can be 100% responsible. And Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib and Mohammed Atta and all of their sick, evil, civilian slaughtering co-conspirators can all be 100% responsible too. I'm just happy to add Feinstein to the list. I didn't realize when I turned up the volume on C-SPAN this morning that I was going to hear her confess to criminal negligence, 3,000 counts of criminally negligent homicide. Oh, or is her office not there under the excuse that she's our security force? That Capitol up on that hill and that White House, that they're all here to protect us. Or is that all somebody else's responsibility? She's only, what, 51% responsible for September 11th happening on her watch? Because that's as low as I'm going to go. I mean, clearly it was Condoleezza Rice's job a little bit more than Dianne Feinstein, right, to stop it. But just a little bit. Well, put it this way. Honestly and seriously. I mean, assuming that you are a decent person and not a Republican or a Democrat, but you're just a human being. If somehow you were a senator, I don't know, the senator died and the governor appointed you senator, and you were a senator in the U.S. Senate, in the United States Senate, and the DCI's hair was on fire about an upcoming Al-Qaeda attack, would you just go on to the next fundraiser? We just go on trying to figure out how to pick a fight with our number one trading partner in Asia? Or would you be concerned? Would you think for a moment that maybe you should take a little bit of responsibility to make sure that, I don't know, the NSA will share their intercepts with the CIA? And that the CIA will share their information about Hazmi and Mihdhar with the FBI and etc. like that? Shake the trees a little bit, you know? Or would you just do like John Ashcroft and just start flying on a private jet? What? An Al-Qaeda threat to aviation? I better keep my mouth shut and stop flying commercial aviation. Oh man, I completely blew that break again. I'm so bad at that. See, I was trying to wrap up that segment a minute ago and then I completely forgot. Well, here's the intro music back from the break. Alright, so there you go, 9/11, all Dianne Feinstein's fault. She knew it was going to happen. In July 2001, major attack coming, she said. And then apparently, did absolutely nothing about it. Alright. So, I'm Scott Horton. And that's first time in a long time I've wasted that much of a show on 9/11 crap. But anyway, the real point is, what a liar she is, that if only the NSA had all the data mining power that they have now, that they could have stopped it. Haven't you ever heard of Able Danger? They already were data mining it. And then they destroyed all that information and did not pass it on to the FBI, the CIA. Hey, there's another little hypothetical for you. You're a military guy, you've got all the Able Danger information, and your bosses are telling you you can't give it to the FBI. What do you do? Go home and drink? Or you go give it to the FBI anyway. Because after all, your boss is wrong and Americans could die en masse, right? Who are these people? This is, again, why I don't understand all the boo-hoo crying about the government shutdown. Who wants the government to exist at all? I want to see a mass government suicide. I'll settle for them all going on a permanent vacation. Like Lou Rockwell said, send them all to Bermuda. Send them to Fiji. Send them on the most expensive tropical vacation you can imagine. All of them. And keep them there. Let them retire no matter what age they are right now. And then, you know, we could have a free society. It would be great. You know, we could have order and stability and justice. I will settle for whatever amount of shutdown I can get. I saw a poll that said some super majority of people thought that the government shutdown was bad. Really? Wow, you know what? If they all started chanting, the government shutdown is bad 10 million times, you could never convince me. So, how could anybody be convinced by that? I don't understand. What part of the government is it that you want to exist? And don't tell me Social Security and everything, for crying out loud. If our government was destroying $10 trillion a year worth of our wealth or whatever, I think there'd be plenty to take care of your Grammy. They spent all your Grammy's healthcare money killing Iraqi babies. That's the only reason you need Social Security. She doesn't have savings anymore because they inflated it all away because they needed that money to kill Iraqi babies with. So you see, we could just abolish the state and your Grammy be fine. Who's afraid of the future so bad they think they need a government? People watch way too much television. That's what I think. Me, I read all day, and it's a nightmare. I just wanted the government to go away. Maybe I need to watch TV, and then I'll be grateful. Oh, thank God, the dang old Dianne Feinstein is here to keep a dangerous world at bay, you know? Think about all the danger we'd be in without her. All the trouble. All right. I'm supposed to be covering the news. I'll tell you this. Scahill wrote a thing about Somalia. Now, I admit, I'm all butthurt about Scahill won't return my emails or phone calls or do my show. He agreed to do my show, and then he stood me up right before the show. That was a few months back, right after I had finished reading his 700-page book. Just because I read his 700-page book doesn't mean he's got to show up and do the show. All right. But now he won't even answer me back. Which, you know, whatever. I guess if I was a big shot, maybe I wouldn't answer anybody back either. Already, I'm pretty bad about answering emails as it is, though I'm trying. But all that to the side, I still got to recommend to you that you read what he writes. And in fact, I guess in this case, it's a Truth Out transcript of his interview on Democracy Now about how American intervention in Somalia is what caused the problem. Because he's a left-winger, he does not recognize the benefit. He doesn't recognize the fact that at the turn of the century, when they had no state at all, was the most peaceful and stable Somali society they had had in generations. He doesn't recognize that because, of course, you have to have a central state. And so but second place, I would concede second place, would be the reign of the Islamic Courts Union. And it's true that they had the will to be authoritarian, as he says. They, were Islamists, and they were kind of hardcore, but they weren't the Taliban because they didn't have the ability to be the Taliban. And really, they weren't bent that far to the right anyway, honestly. Pretty far, but not that freaking far. And so, but anyway, go and you can read it. If you look at my Facebook page, facebook.com/Scott Horton Show, you can find it. In fact, let me page down here and find the title. It's Al-Shabaab, and I guess everybody started dropping the double A in Shabaab. That's good. Okay. Al-Shabaab's Nairobi Mall Rampage tied. Man, I'm getting really bad at talking lately, which is problematic since I talk for my job. Scahill. Al-Shabaab's Nairobi Mall Rampage tied to disastrous U.S. meddling in Somalia. Well, he's completely right about that. And he tells the story very well. And he went there and he interviewed the warlords himself and did a great job. And, you know, really what you should do is, you know, regardless of the most recent update, you should read his article, Blowback in Somalia, in The Nation. It was written about 2 years ago now, I think. He does the real good. First this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened, and it's just the American-led cycle of violence. That's all it is. How America took just fine and turned it into a nightmare. And in fact, if you read my most recent piece at fff.org, U.S. to blame for Somalia's misery, you can see about the famine and America's role in the war's role in making the famine that much worse.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the thing here. Yeah, now, so what I was saying there at the break, the famine. And this is why Thomas Mountain accused Scahill of being a spokesman for the CIA, basically, that he left out the worst part of the story, which was the famine. And I don't think he's a spokesman for the CIA at all, but he left out the famine again in this thing. With Democracy Now, which is the most important point of it all. You see, there's a massive drought on the Horn of Africa, but the people who all starved to death, they were the Somalis, because America had turned their nation upside down. So whatever crops were growing, there was no market for the food to be distributed. And so the people just laid down and died, 260,000 of them. According to the U.S. and the U.K. governments, 250,000 people starved to death. And approximately half of those were children under 5 years old. And that's what my article is about at fff.org, U.S. government to blame for Somalia's misery. It's integrating these two stories together. Scahill's rendition of, Uncle Sam's role in the cycle of violence since the turn of the century, making everything worse and worse and worse and worse and worse there all this time. 12 years and counting now. But then also the famine and how capitalism was unable to prevent the famine. You know, capitalism can't prevent bad weather, but capitalism can prevent famines. Capitalism does prevent famines. In fact, the only place where there's ever famine is where there's no capitalism. Because capitalism provides for, trucks full of food, traveling to where they're needed. Those calories need to be burned. Anyway, you know the deal. So 260,000 innocent civilians starved to death. Can you imagine that? I think back to when I was in, would have been third grade, USA for Africa. Michael Jackson and Cyndi Lauper and everybody, we're going to all hold hands across America and sing a song. It didn't quite work out. I think they might have underestimated how wide America is. But they did their giant hands across America thing to help feed the starving Ethiopians. Well, why were the Ethiopians starving? Well, they had a war too. It was called Soviet communism. That's why they were all starving. Their government was waging war against them, had rounded them all up off of their private property and put them on collective farms, complete with razor wire and guard towers, and proceeded to starve them all to death. Well, in this case, the communism was brought to the Somalis by the Americans. And it's not really communism as much as it's just explosions, torture, that kind of stuff. Anyway, The reason this really matters, other than it's just, you know, horrible sin, is because of the blowback. And the way it works in American foreign policy is whatever our government does wrong, great. Because the consequences will be the excuse for the next step of intervention. And nobody ever calls them on it. History began in 1941. History began in 1991. History began in 2001. History began day before yesterday. You don't need to know who or what or why or any kind of backstory to the rise of the Al-Shabaab militia in Somalia and their different factional disputes and what all that has to do with the attack on the mall in Kenya. You don't need to know that. All you need to know is a Muslim did a violent thing to somebody. And he wasn't working for the U.S. at the time. And so therefore, maybe we need to begin intervening in Somalia now. That was the narrative all over TV last week. Boy, this Al-Shabaab militia seems like it's starting to become a problem. Maybe we should begin to intervene there. And they can get away with that. Because other than me and other than Scahill and, you know, Mountain and a couple of others, no one will tell you the backstory. Nobody knows the backstory. Sheldon Richmond does a good job. Nobody else even knows the backstory to tell it. Nobody on TV knows it, right? All these TV hairdos, they're not ignoring it and or they're not lying about it. They just never even heard of it in the first place. Oh, did you hear there was a thing that happened at a mall? And they're not even curious. The best they're going to do is read Jeffrey Gettleman writing from his hotel lobby in the New York Times. Which, for those of you who've ever read Gettleman, you get the joke. For those of you who haven't, the punchline is, that guy is worthless, and his journalism is worthless. I mean, he's a laughingstock. He's like, you know, David Sanger and William J. Broad and Michael Gordon and other lowlifes at the New York Times. Except, you know, I don't think Sanger or Broad for a minute could try to be as pretty as Jeffrey Gettleman. Boy, is he pretty with that perm and everything. Well, it's a very nice hotel lobby where he does his journalism from. He's got to fit in, you know. Anyway. Same thing's going on in Nigeria. Approximately the same latitude, but over there to the west. Well, there's this group called Boko Haram. And now, if you listen to the American media, they'll tell you that Boko Haram means Western education is forbidden. All right, well, I think we all already know what haram means. Forbidden. So now you're telling me Boko means Western education? Nuh-uh. That's ridiculous. And you know what? I actually feel like an idiot now because I don't remember what it means anymore. I thought that if I started talking about it, that my brain would come up with what it actually means. It's back there somewhere, but I shouldn't have taken that left turn at Albuquerque, I guess. But I've had emailers in the past who have set me straight about that. In fact, let me search my email for Boko and see if I can find it, man, because I've gotten the real translation before. People have told me that before. Here you go. Blam. First thing that comes up. Boko is the name for Hausa language when written in the Latin alphabet. Hausa. Okay, so I can sort of kind of see where they get that from, right? Don't write our local language in your foreign script. Something like that. Meh. Oh, wait. Here's a follow-up here. No. All right. Anyway, so Boko Haram, they're just a local group of right-wing crazies from the backwoods, Islamist crazies from the backwoods of Nigeria. Who cares? What's it got to do with us? Nothing. Unless you want a problem there. Now, I have to admit, and I hate the damned Democrats, but I think that, the right-wing criticism of the Democrats is actually a correct one. That they're tiny little cowards. And I'm so grateful for that. I mean, I really think that if it had been John McCain, and first of all, I think he would have gotten us into a war with Russia. You may not know this about John McCain, but he's got a real thing about Russia. A bad one. And he's just the right mix of hate and ignorance to get us into something like that. He really is that horrible. But even that to the side, even if it had been McCain, even if he hadn't got us all reduced to nuclear cinders by now, I think he would have just absolutely had no problem with full-scale intervention in Syria, full-scale intervention in Libya, and then chase those consequences to Mali. Put the Navy SEALs in their new and improved Swift boats up and down the Niger Delta. Send the entire Marine Corps to Uganda to hunt Joseph Kony. Why not? Never mind carpet bombing Syria or Iran the whole time. So I'm not saying that, the Democrats are worthy of support or that they're wise or cautious or have anything like the U.S. national interest in mind. I just think Obama is a scaredy cat. I think he's a tiny little coward. And I don't mean to mock. I sure hope that the president isn't listening to my show right now because I'd hate to provoke him. I just think it couldn't possibly be prudence or wisdom or responsibility at play here. He's just scared. And thank God for that. Because we could be doing a lot worse in Nigeria now. And you can be sure that the Joint Special Operations Command and probably the CIA and whoever are running around there. They're certainly running around in Mali, where there was another suicide bombing the other day, by the way. Running around in North Africa, where I was trying to get Patrick Coburn back on the show to cover Libya for us. He wrote a couple of things for The Independent, and I read a thing at Vice, actually, about Libya as well. But then check this out. Now, this was a Fox News story. And I think it pretty much stayed there. It didn't get that much coverage, but here it is at the Daily Caller. Millions in advanced U.S. weaponry stolen by Libyan jihadis. Now, that may be that the CIA or the JSOC just gave it to them. Night vision goggles, Humvees, and guns. Hundreds of M4 automatic rifles, Glock pistols, laser targeting devices, heavily armored Humvees, grenade launchers. It's not just equipment, it's the capability, one source told Fox. You're giving these dangerous groups the capability that only a few nations are capable of. All these militias are tied to terrorist organizations and jihadist movements. So there you go. Tried to tell you before the Libya war, the one redeeming quality in the life of Muammar Gaddafi is that Al-Qaeda hates him and so he hates them back. And he's interested in keeping them down. And that America should not be fighting a war on behalf of the Libyans who went to fight America in Iraq. As part of Zarqawi's group, which maybe that's oversimplifying it, but just a little bit. I mean, virtually all the foreign fighters that went to Iraq went and fought with Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the so-called Islamic State of Iraq, the same group that's called ISIS in Syria right now. Zarqawi's berserkers, the Libyan Islamic fighting group, and Ansar al-Sharia, the guys behind the Benghazi attack of a year ago. And, I'm sorry, I'm spacing out on another prominent name of a Libyan militia that went and fought in Iraq and then came back to Libya since then. Anyway, they're all from Benghazi, basically. And, you know, the London Independent said, hey, this guy, Hasidi says, yeah, I fought with the Taliban against America in Afghanistan, and yeah, I fought with Al-Qaeda against America in Iraq. But don't worry about me, I'm a nice guy. And Hakim al-Belhaj, too, said, yeah, I'm a veteran of the Iraq War, or I fought against the Americans. In fact, his story was that the CIA and the MI6 at one point had kidnapped him, renditioned him off to a dungeon in Thailand to be tortured, and then rendered him to Gaddafi to be tortured. That was way back in ancient history when Gaddafi worked for George W. Bush torturing Al-Qaeda guys. Well then, so here comes Barack Obama, fights a war for these guys. This is the whole thing about, you want to talk about a limited hangout. The whole scandal about Benghazi is the limited hangout. The scandal is the whole war was fought for Ansar al-Sharia and their buddies. And their, you know, like-minded warring groups. And there is no state in Libya anymore. And now maybe there will be someday. There may be an American full-scale invasion someday. I guess it depends, how badly the violence spreads and whether our government wants that or not, right? Like right now, our government is in the business of destabilizing Syria. So if we can spread the jihad out of Libya and into Syria, fine. But say, for example, they really are interested in propping up and keeping the kings of Morocco and Algeria and the violence spreading out of, or and maybe they want to double down protecting renewed military dictatorship in Egypt, and too much of the violence is spreading out of Libya to those countries, well, then they might just, we might find our government intervening. And this is my horrible prediction that so far I'm wrong about, and I hope I stay wrong about, is that as soon as we're done winning the Libyan war, I told you 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, I said, as soon as we're done winning this war, then the next logical step is we can't let the people that we just fought for win. We can't let the winners win. They're the bad guys. So then, just like in Syria, right? We can't let Al-Qaeda win, the guys we've been backing this whole time. If they do, we'll have to intervene and do something about it. You know, war on terror and all. And so then, next logical step to me was full-scale invasion, training up a secular army, and purple-fingered elections, and a bunch of crap just like the invasion of Iraq, only hopefully a little bit easier. And so far, that hasn't happened. But like I say, I think that's only just because they've been successful, mostly. Don't tell Ambassador Stevens or his family or his bodyguards' families about this. But other than them, they've been mostly successful in funneling, you know, quote-unquote successful, in funneling this extremism to Syria where they want it. But, I don't know. Things could fall apart. And, you know, this is actually an interview I'm working on arranging. That guy, Nick Terse, he's a really hard-working guy. I don't hold it against him that he's really hard to get a hold of. He actually did email me back just to say, sorry, I'm so hard to get a hold of. I'll try you again soon, kind of a thing. But he wrote this insane thing, first of all, with Bob Dreyfus at The Nation about America's Afghan victims, about the civilian casualties of the Afghan war. Of course, Bob Dreyfus, probably because of me, I guess, I don't know, is completely sworn off doing radio forever, he says. But anyway, I want to get Nick Terse. They wrote that thing together for The Nation. I miss Bob, dude. He is so good on so much stuff. But then also, and this is the point I'm trying to get to, Terse wrote this thing for Tom Dispatch called AFRICOM's Gigantic Small Footprint. And small footprint, of course, is in quotes there. You know, the ironical kind. And, you know, the article's about the full-scale invasion of the Dark Continent. There's resources to be stolen. There's hegemony to be preserved. And I guess it's too politically incorrect now to just kidnap Africans en masse and force them to work for free on your plantation and stuff like that. But you can still go and enslave them in their own land, no problem. So, that's the American policy. Jeez, we keep having to suffer consequences from our interventions in the Middle East, and Russia and China do have nukes enough to keep us at bay there, I guess. You know who we could go pick on? Oh, and the Europeans, they're all our allies. Let's go pick on Africans. You know, from Egypt to Uganda, we'll just shoot people. Steal stuff. All right. Now, let's see what time it is. Coming up here in a few minutes, Trita Parsi's going to be on the show to talk about the prospects of talks with Iran on their nuclear program. And really what he wrote about here in Foreign Affairs, Pushing Peace is the title of it. And it's about, well, I don't want to spoil it for you too much, but it's about how peace with Iran, peace between America and Iran, or a real opening up and rapprochement, warming up, whatever, relations, a nuclear deal, whatever degree, with Iran, is in the best interests of Israel. And so the article is, you know, here are Israel's fears, but here's why you need to relax, man. It's all right. And I think it's a good piece, and I want to give it as much attention as I can. All right, let's see the clock here. All right. Well, so I got more news to cover here. I got more Syria. I got Iraq. I got F-35s. So I want to complain about F-35s. But, well, here, I'll tell you this real quick. Well, two things. First of all, I blew the first two breaks on the show today because I'm horrible at this. So, let me tell you that this show is brought to you by the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org, by the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org, by Wall Street Window at wallstreetwindow.com, and by Fuse Powder. I think you might have heard that. Oh, no, I did play that break, didn't I? The Fuse Powder and Audible Trial. You heard that. Okay, good. But yeah, so what you missed was Future Freedom Foundation, the Council for the National Interest, and Wall Street Window. And now, so here's the thing. I'm working on a brand new fund drive, I guess, in celebration of 3,000 interviews. Yesterday was the 3,000th interview. As I said on the show yesterday, give or take a couple of lost ones. But anyway, yesterday was 3,000 interviews. They're all there at scotthorton.org for you. Ann Jones was number 3,000. And so I'm going to do a little fun drive here. And basically the deal is, as you know, it's been, well, more than a year now since I left antiwar.com. And now I'm doing this thing on my own. I'm not on any major network or anything like that. I'm on no agenda, but they don't pay me. This is just a cottage industry kind of a gig here. And now I do have a gig now with Liberty Express. That's not paying me either. However, I think that is, other than KPFK, which they'll never pay me, even if I have a show on Pacifica for 100 years, they'll never pay me, I don't think. So I'm not even worried about that. But Liberty Express, I think there's some real possibility there that Liberty Express will soon even, turn into a very real radio network and or maybe an XM network, something like that. And maybe I can make a little bit of money that way. They definitely got great numbers and a bunch of other great hosts on there. Tom Woods is on there now with his new show, and Peter Schiff is on there. He's got a huge audience and a bunch of other great guys. So that's LibertyExpressRadio.com. Very happy to be on there. But anyway, long story short, to get from the short term through the medium term to the long term, where something like that happens, where my way is really paid, I have to stop from time to time and do kind of mini fun drives like this and ask for y'all's support. You know, if you value the show. And basically the deal is this. I know that most people who are interested in foreign policy don't really like me very much. And I know that most people who at least would like me or could like me very much aren't usually very interested in foreign policy. So the kind of people who are interested in foreign policy and they want to hear from me and from my guests and they want to hear these guests interviewed by me, you're kind of a niche. You're kind of a few and a far between. I wish there were more of you, but on the flip side of that, I know that those of you who really dig the show really dig the show and really put a lot of value on it. And I know that I get emails and messages and tweets and whatever from time to time that reveal the fact that, you know, especially, you know, here and there, not for all of you regular listeners, but for some of you, it's really made a difference in what you know and how you think and how you conceive of American foreign policy and for the better. And so, you know, for those of you who really appreciate the show, go ahead and read up on marginal utility and make sure that you know exactly how much you value the wealth that you've been able to collect so far. And then whatever portion of that you think you'd like to chip in on the show, then hey, why not go ahead? The easiest thing to do would be to send it by PayPal to scott@scotthorton.org for donations, or if you just go to scotthorton.org/donate, you can find the snail mail address. So there's the pitch for donations. But you know what I really need? I need speaking gigs. Because those pay okay, you know? Get a bunch of different people to chip in a little. I'd be happy to travel and do a speech. And in fact, I get a good deal on travel, so I can give you a good deal on travel when it comes to stuff like that. And I need advertisers on this show. You hear the commercials. I do a wonderful job advertising for stuff. I need advertisers. And I need all those of you who are already advertising to pay more. No, but seriously, I need more advertisers. And in fact, you could ask the other advertisers. I charge very little. I'm extremely flexible on what I'll charge you to advertise on this show. But every little bit really helps. And I don't cost very much. But utilities do. The new website, I'm going to need some custom work and some real level 10 computer genius type custom work for the new website. That's going to cost some money. The electric bill, calling Ann Jones in Norway and Pepe Escobar in Hong Kong and all this, Adam Morrow in Cairo, it ain't free. I got to raise money one way or another or else there's no show. So, donate at scotthorton.org/donate or contact me about advertising on the show for your company or whatever your project is that you're interested in doing. scott@scotthorton.org is my email address. And, of course, that's also how to get a hold of me to arrange a speech. You could also go to Same Side Entertainment, although I don't know whatever happened with that. Is that even a thing anymore? I haven't heard back from them in a long, long time, but they were supposed to be arranging some speaking gigs and stuff. And really, I'd be happy to share the money with them on their percentage basis like we agreed if they were getting it done. But anyway, check out all the information that you need for all this stuff at scotthorton.org if you'd be so kind, and thank you. Appreciate it.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy. And all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. NIAcouncil.org. is the website for the National Iranian American Council, led by its founder, Trita Parsi. Welcome back to the show. Trita, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Scott. How are you? I love that sticker advertisement you had there.
Oh, you like that? I think you missed the beginning, too. All the fun stuff is at the beginning. Get your son killed. Jeb Bush, 2016. In fact, I get emails from time to time. People say, you know, I'm really not a bumper sticker guy, but I did just spend an hour at that website laughing my ass off. So even if you don't like buying them, it's still fun anyway. And you know what? You can get Liberty stickers on magnets, too. All right. Anyway,
Interesting.
Yeah. It's my old company, actually. I invented it, but then I sold it so I could be a radio guy.
Interesting. I had no idea.
And then here, I would have never been able to keep it in business for 10 years like this, I promise you. But good old Rick has kept it going this whole time. It's a great little thing. Anyway, let's talk about your awesome new article in Foreign Affairs. That's at foreignaffairs.com. And for whatever reason, it's not behind the paywall or whatever. They'll let us all read it. It's called Pushing Peace: How Israel Can Help the United States Strike a Deal with Iran, and Why It Should. Well, isn't that an interesting take? And you start off by kind of cataloging the fears of the Israeli government, the Netanyahu government, over what bad might happen to Israel or for Israel if America and Iran can, I think, even really begin down this road of, you know, possible rapprochement, obviously starting with the nuclear program here. So what is it that they're so terrified of, Trita?
So from the Israeli perspective, or I would say the perspective in particular right now of the Netanyahu government, the fear is that any deal that the U.S. would be able to strike with Iran is worse than the status quo. Because any deal that is realistic would give Iran certain degrees and elements of the nuclear fuel cycle. So there will, for instance, most likely be enrichment on Iranian soil under any deal. It's just that that enrichment would be heavily inspected, and it would be restricted. It would be full transparency. But from the Israeli perspective, the current situation with massive escalating sanctions, threats of war, is a more preferable situation than to Iran even having a very limited nuclear program for two very simple reasons. One, the fear then is that from the Israeli side, that Iran would nevertheless be able to shift the balance of power in the region because it will have a virtual nuclear capability. And that would reduce Israel's maneuverability. And the second, which is perhaps more fascinating, is the fact that the Israelis realize or calculate or believe that the U.S. would essentially make up with Iran, at least to a certain extent, and it would move on to other issues. Whereas Israel would still be faced with a hostile Israeli-Iranian relationship, and as a result would feel abandoned because now it would have to face Iran alone. What this calculation does not take into account, however, is that it is actually through U.S.-Iran talks and a diplomatic deal that we have the best chance of changing Iran's position vis-a-vis Israel, which actually then would help Israel. And there are people in Israel who know and understand this. And there are those who don't believe that that will be good enough, but realize it's not that bad. And there are those who, like Netanyahu, are so deep into this position of just trying to prevent a deal that they continue on that path even at the expense of the damage that it actually does right now to U.S.-Israeli relations.
Mm. Now, the thing is, I guess, does Netanyahu even want a war or a regime change anymore? It seems like everyone in the world agrees that, you know, you can't do a real war, you know, invade and sack Tehran like Baghdad or whatever. Nobody contemplates that. But then it seems like also, isn't it pretty much consensus that you're not going to be able to redo a 1953 style coup here either? You just cannot have regime change in Iran. So the choices are either just deal with it and respect their independence and negotiate in good faith, or the status quo, just continue to insist until regime change comes somehow, you know, someday, in just some vague way. I mean, is that basically what the positions are here?
Well, I mean, remember that the status quo, part of the reason why the status quo is attractive from the perspective of someone like Netanyahu, is that it keeps the hope of war alive, while at the same time keeping in place all of the sanctions. What do the sanctions do? They don't change Iran's behavior. They just are undermining Iran's power in the region. And that's what, from Israel's perspective, they want. They've seen that Iran has been rising in the region, that it has had momentum on its side, and they want to reverse this trend, and they want to reestablish the old balance of power in the region. Sanctions, for that reason, is absolutely essential. It has really not that much to do with the nuclear program, as it has to do with the fact that from Israel's perspective, it is very helpful that these sanctions are just undermining the very foundation of Iranian power in the region because it's destroying the economy, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. They would prefer that to be in place more or less permanently. A nuclear deal would mean that sanctions would get lifted, would mean that Iran would be able to live up to its full potential in the region. And Iran that lives up to its full potential in the region is going to be far more powerful than Israel. Even if it's not hostile against Israel, that's not a scenario that Israel would like to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I was reminded when I was reading your piece here, again, it's at Foreign Affairs Pushing Peace. I was reminded of the interview that Netanyahu and Barak gave to Jeffrey Goldberg back in, I guess it would have been 09 then. Yeah, because they were threatening war next year, would have been 10 at the time, I think.
It was 2010.
Oh, was it 10? Okay, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, and so they specify in there that the existential threat is, one, is the brain drain, that maybe talented Israelis would go to America for grad school and then stay if they were afraid of an Iranian nuclear bomb. But then the other, you know, so-called definition of the existential threat to Israel there is what you talk about, just their freedom of action being limited. They want to be able to invade southern Lebanon from time to time without ever having to worry about whether Iran is going to do anything about it or not. It's not even whether they could really do anything about it. They just don't want to have to consider that, basically. They want to be the unquestioned hegemon. And that's the existential threat.
Yeah, what they define as an existential threat is the fact that they can't, you know, take military action at free will. And as you mentioned, whether it is to go into Lebanon over and over again, but also to make sure that they have the U.S.'s backing for all of these different things. If you do have a deal between Iran and the United States on a nuclear issue, I don't foresee the U.S. and Iran becoming best friends or close partners. But there's going to be a lot of areas of common interest between these two countries that can be explored, that can be very beneficial for both and for the region as a whole. And that also means that suddenly the U.S. is not going to knee-jerk always take Israel's side on issues, and that's something the Israelis are very worried about. But if you go to the core of what would be good for Israel, it would be really good for Israel if the position of Iran vis-a-vis Israel were to become much softer, if there wasn't this degree of hostility, if there wasn't an effort by the Iranians, at least during the Ahmadinejad years, to question Israel's right to exist. So Israel actually would be in a safer position, but in a less dominant position. And from the perspective of people like Netanyahu, it seems like he prefers unsafety plus domination than safety without domination.
Right, yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing, this whole Shiite axis. I mean, first of all, Netanyahu helped push us into the war against Iraq, which really empowered Iran more than anything that's ever happened to them since the Ayatollah took over in 79. And of course, whenever they talk about, oh, the dangerous Shiite crescent, they always leave out Iraq because everybody knows it's their fault, so they don't want to draw attention to that. But but then, so who cares if there's a Shiite arc if the leading power in the Shiite arc is a friend of ours, the Iranians, or at least if the hostility is diminished so badly. As you point out in your piece here, Rouhani and his men, these are the guys who were behind the golden offer of 2003, the one where they not only put the entire nuclear program on the table for negotiation, but even said, hey, we'll switch sides in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or at least we'll put pressure on them to disarm and simply become political parties, Hamas and Hezbollah, that kind of thing. I mean, it just doesn't make much sense to me why to continue to resist such a great opportunity, even from the Israeli point of view, you know?
Exactly. And I think there are people in Israel who realize this. And unfortunately, they're stuck with a leader right now who essentially is the worst placed person to make this shift, in the sense that Netanyahu has come to personify the argument that Iran is the reincarnation of Germany, that it's in 1938, and Ahmadinejad is Hitler, etc., etc. Other leaders in Israel, who may not at all be, you know, less belligerent or less hawkish, but people like Ehud Barak have consistently said that Iran is not an existential threat, because that's an insult to Israeli power to say that Iran could be an existential threat. So he can make the shift without paying a high political price. But if you have based your career almost on the idea that Iran is an existential threat, how are you going to shift and favor diplomacy suddenly? That's going to go against everything you've said for the last 20 years.
Right.
Israel needs a leader that has the nimbleness right now to make this shift, to react appropriately to very, very stark geopolitical changes in the region right now. And if Iran and the U.S. were to come on better terms, that would be the biggest development in the region since 1979.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you point out here, they still got along after the revolution in the 1980s. Ronald Reagan sold the Ayatollah missiles by way of Israel. So
exactly.
That's post-revolution era. So
absolutely.
And in fact,
exactly,
the way you bring that up in the article is in talking about Iran's regular hawkish statements about Palestine, and how that's really how they shore up their credibility with the Arab world and the Sunni world, is to take the side of the Palestinians all the time and bash Israel all the time. And yet, as evidenced by the history of the policy here, yeah, they can put those concerns on the back burner, and they can work with Israel if they want to buy some TOW missiles from Ronald Reagan, for example, something like that, no big deal.
Yeah.
So absolutely. Geopolitics, as they call it, I hate that term, but that takes precedence over any ideological or religious affinity or even political affinity for the Palestinians, if that's the weight of the politics, if those incentives are lined up correctly.
Exactly.
Very important point there. And now I wanted to point out, too, about or ask you what you think about when you talk about diminishing the sanctions, diminishing Iranian power. It seems to me like America and Israel, and I don't know if they're really smart enough to be doing this on purpose or anything, maybe. It seems like they're using Al-Qaeda in Syria to hurt Iran, basically using the tried and true Al-Qaeda method of luring their enemy in and bleeding them to death, the same way that they did to us in Afghanistan and in Iraq, they're now doing to the Iranians. And they're completely destroying Hezbollah and the Iranian government's popularity in the Arab world by pitting them against the Sunni majority in Syria. What do you think about that?
I think that may be a correct assessment if you were talking about the policy of the Saudis, in the sense that I think from the Saudi perspective, there is a desire to keep the situation in Syria going on the way that it is right now, because it drains the Iranians, it helps the Saudis get rid of their own radicals. They just send them to Syria, either they get killed or they kill someone from Assad's side, and either way, the House of Saud wins. I don't think this is the calculation from the American side. I think our calculations are more confusing, but also more complex. From the Saudi side, I don't think they're too... I mean, I'm sure they would like to win in Syria, but at the same time, the current status quo is not too problematic for them. I think the urgency to reach a deal is greater on the American side, on the Iranian side, even on Assad's side, than it is on the Saudi side.
Because just keeping the whole thing going, I wonder, do you think they're even trying to win now? It seems like Obama, at least, for the Americans' point of view, they basically, with the Russia deal, they've given up on regime change and Assad must go. That's all, from my point of view, thankfully, now just words. And the policy now is there's no marker to draw the red line with anymore, and so Assad can stay. Am I right about that?
I don't think the U.S. will ever go out and say that Assad can stay. But I think the position that existed before was that Assad is going to go anyway, so the U.S. might as well put that forward as a condition. Mm-hmm. But now I think it's quite clear that Assad is not easily going to go, and in fact, he is winning this. And as a result, there's going to have to be some acrobatics on seeing how the U.S. deals with this situation. I think personally that the chances of diplomacy succeeding and actually getting off the ground would have been much, much greater if we had not made such pronunciations of this person has to go, that person has to go. I mean, I personally hope for a Syria in the future that is completely peaceful and that does not entail those who have so much blood on their hands, which definitely includes Assad. But that's for the Syrian people to decide, not for anyone from the outside necessarily to put as a precondition for a diplomatic process. Mm-hmm. When you put preconditions like that, you essentially give belligerents no incentives to stop being belligerents, because the political process, the diplomatic process, is about getting rid of them. Why would they engage in that diplomatic process?
Right. Yeah, Brendan O'Neill at Spiked Online over there in the UK did a great piece cataloging how the various statements by the Brits and the Americans about Assad's so-called legitimacy from their point of view helped destroy any real progress that was being made. And there was some real progress being made as far as reforms and their elections and compromises and rewriting the Constitution. And, you know, nothing like you or I would have done if we had magic power to make it the way we want it. But there was actual progress being made, and America undermined it all with all of their pronouncements about Assad's legitimacy back in, you know, 2 years ago.
I think there's some truth in that. Of course, a lot of things have undermined it. I wouldn't say that was necessarily the final straw of things. But if we take a look at the diplomacy that the U.S. successfully had, for instance, in putting an end to the civil war in former Yugoslavia, of course, there was a military component to it as well. But, you know, we brought all of the key leaders to Dayton, Ohio, including Milosevic. We never said, even though we thought of Milosevic as a butcher, we never said that Milosevic's exit from political life would be a precondition for being able to participate in the process.
Right. All right, now we're almost...
And by doing that in Syria, we've really undermined our prospects for diplomacy.
All right, now, I know you got to go. We got just a couple of seconds here before the break. But I want to ask you real quick whether you think the basic feeling about Netanyahu's speech yesterday was that it fell flat, and we're going to go ahead and go with Obama's push for talks here, and we'll get back to Netanyahu later if we have to, kind of thing. Is that about right, you think?
I think he was perhaps a bit softer than he had hoped for, but I do believe that he's not at all taking the position that he needs to take for the interest of Israel itself.
Okay. Thanks very much. I sure appreciate
it. Thanks so much. Talk to you soon. Bye.
That's Trita Parsi, everybody, from the National Iranian American Council. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future.
You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why Peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott.
Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the Journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Now, you know they publish great articles at fff.org every day, but their best stuff goes in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online, and I got a new one coming out in September in there, U.S. Responsible for Somalia's Misery. Support FFF. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe and tell them Scott sent you.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. 3,000 interviews now at scotthorton.org. And some other stuff, too. Whole show archives are there. Stress blog is there. The donate page is there at scotthorton.org/donate. 3,000 interviews. There's something worth supporting. So I guess that's approximately 500 a year. I think maybe I need to get my ass in gear. That's hardly any, right? Something, I don't know. All right. ScottHorton.org. So, yeah, and I got some plans for doing things a little bit better around here. If I can get my resources together, see if I can improve the product for you a little bit. Working on it. Big thanks to my friend Dave for redesigning the website at ScottHorton.org. And hell, while I'm at it, big thanks to everybody who's helped me with the show over the years. And that's a lot of different people. And you know who you are, the different antiwar.com interns. And then, well, of course, antiwar.com as an organization. Justin and Eric and Angela, of course, was producer for the show for a long time. Adam McDonald has been editing and posting the interviews for years now. Mark Jokel helped with that for a long time. Brandon Snyder, of course, a big honorable mention for him. He helped set up Stress and all that back in the first place. Hell, Tracy helped me get this whole thing going back 10 years ago. So, anyway, thanks to all y'all. Of course, my lovely bride helps produce the show, at least from time to time. At least she used to. Not as much now, but whatever, you know, it's all right. So yeah, and I'm certainly leaving a lot of people out, and that's why I said the thing about you know who you are, all the various volunteers who've come and gone. Of course, Sneaker helps me keep the servers and has arranged me the best deal on bandwidth in North America. So and on servers that are donated by our good friend Purger, and listen, I could go on and on the rest of the show telling you who I'm grateful for as far as helping me put this thing together. Jeez, man, all my tech guys, the people from RJ, the audio genius, to Tommy, the computer genius. I lost Tommy's number, man. I don't know whatever happened to Tommy. But anyway, man, thank you all, everybody who's helped out so far. I ain't dead yet. So there you go, scotthorton.org, and yeah, it's a new little mini fun drive thing. I guess if you've ever donated to me before, there's going to be a spam in your email box here before too long.
tonight or tomorrow or something about why to help donate and support the show. And especially, why to advertise on the show. That way, you know, it's like donating, only you also get stuff. Ads. So, you know. All right. Let's take some phone calls. You want to do some phone calls? I meant to do phone calls yesterday on the show. I had it all set up to do phone calls yesterday on the show. And then I forgot to say, I just started complaining about stuff, I guess. And I forgot to take a single freaking call. I forgot to give out the number to ask for a single call. But so let me do better about that. Here's the number if you want to call in the show. It's 512, that's Austin, 512-271-4836 or 877-513-0792. 512-271-4836 or 877-513-0792. Call in and say hi, or call in and say I suck at this, or call in and say whatever you want. Talk about any of America's wars. We've got a lot of them to choose from. So, there you go. And we've got a little while left in the show to take calls, too. So, I'm putting out a tweet now. Taking calls! So, call in the show. I guess I should put the link to the show on there for people who ain't already listening. All right. So there you go. It's 512-271-4836 or 877-513-0792. I should do like the question of the day or whatever. So how about, don't you hate XXX a lot? Whatever. I don't know. I hate things a lot. Maybe you want to call in and talk about what you hate. I love this. Watchdog finds 719 problems with the Pentagon's F-35 program. 719? That's all? You know, the American people, all of us, except the ones who know better, but everybody else, criminal stupidity here. Just criminal stupidity for letting these people get away with this. I mean, what is the U.S. military other than a welfare program for people who are already rich? Bunch of Lockheed executives get to go on vacation on our hard-earned money for putting out a bunch of crap. Oh, yeah, the F-35 is great, except you can't fly it in the rain. Oh, yeah, the F-35 is great, except we can't get the cockpit open. Call out the fire department with the jaws of life. Got Dave stuck in the cockpit again. Oh, it's not stealthy at all if you turn the knob on your radar from the right to the left. Oh, there it is. And it can't carry nearly enough bombs because that would take away the whole pretended stealthiness that ain't even there anyway. And those are just the terrible flaws in the damn thing. I know off the top of my head, I know there are a hell of a lot more than that. 719 problems. And the same thing, $400 billion has been spent on this thing, by the way. According to them, that's as much as they admit. 719 issues that could, quote, adversely affect aircraft performance, reliability, maintainability, and ultimately cost. Yeah, the Marines sure need a bunch of jump jets because, you know, whenever you're taking a beachhead, it makes perfect sense that you're going to make a nice little airbase and you're going to bring in unlimited amounts of resources for the care and feeding of these vertical takeoff F-35s. Anyway, the whole thing is just a gang rape. That's all it is. One big mugging. If you look at the F-35 and you think, wow, what a neat plane, without thinking, man, they're holding down the entire American people and raping us and stealing all our money for a bunch of crap, then you're cheating yourself. I mean, I gotta admit that assuming you could get one of these things to take off without just falling out of the sky or something like that, and you could go and have fun for the afternoon flying around in it, it's probably fun to fly around in. But are any of the versions of the F-35 or the F-22 even necessary at all? Much less, I mean, is it even necessary, I guess the way to put it, is it even necessary to improve upon the F-16s, the F-18s, the F-15s that we already have? And then the question is, are either of these planes an actual improvement? Now, maybe they go a little bit faster, fly a little bit higher, or a tiny bit more stealthier here, there, or the other place. But taken, you know, pound for pound, Air Force dollar for dollar, killing capability for killing capability, is it even worth it at all to upgrade from F-15s to these? Is it even an upgrade? And do you know anyone in the Air Force? Ask that person. Hey, isn't it the case that a fleet of F-15s could kill any government's Air Force in an afternoon? And they will say to you, yeah, F-15s can kill you from hundreds and hundreds of miles away. F-15's nose cones nowadays can kill you by looking at you, to paraphrase the late great Bill Hicks. They don't even need these at all. It's just a gigantic screw job. Okay, if it's not just a gigantic screw job, then answer me why they didn't design it where you can fly it in the rain. Well, what if there was a war on a rainy day? It's, you know, a few hundred billion dollars here, a few hundred billion dollars there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. All right, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show. How's it going?
Hey, Scott, it's Fitz out of San Francisco. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good, but you sound kind of echoey back there, or maybe I do.
No problem. I'm in the car. 1 second. Let me get off the... Get off. Okay. Is that any better?
Yes, sir. Sure is.
Okay. Yeah, basically, I was going to stick on the same topic. I was going to bring up the S-35 before you even brought it up. They want to, instead of shutting down the government, well, you just got to eliminate one program there, and I'm sure that'll at least give them a couple more months, like given the $1 trillion that thing's going to cost.
Right.
But I was going to bring up also that you're saying how the Marines don't need these. Well, they actually might now, because if those two generals just got, well, they say fired, but actually they were forced into retirement where they get the $140,000 a month or a year for the rest of their lives.
Right.
But two Marine generals, because they left a post in Afghanistan, you know, unguarded, and the Taliban destroyed 200 million in Harriers and killed a couple of Marines. But I was going to say, at least that was the first time I've ever seen that there's actually some kind of accountability. But, of course, as far as that goes, it's just the folks get retired.
Right, yeah. Not quite relieved of command. But, you know, yeah, I read a thing.
Yeah.
I read a thing that said this is the first time that a general has been, you know, removed, quote unquote, one way or the other, since World War II or some, for battlefield era.
Since Vietnam.
Since Vietnam, yeah. And, you know, now Gates fired a general over Walter Reed, right? But, and you know, a couple other generals have been fired for, you know, sexual harassment, this, that, or the other thing. But this is for battlefield failures.
Yes. Yeah, but I was just thinking that, regardless of all that, someone should be fired for, you know, for approving the F-35 for this long until it gets to be $1 trillion in the hole. I guess some people were debating whether or not, Lockheed, whether they actually want it to be where they have to scrap the whole program and start over, if that's almost the goal, because, of course, that would be more profitable for them, since they're really the only, since they've either bought up or driven out of business all their competitors. I mean,
you know, I saw internet troll attacking Winslow Wheeler Wenzel Wheeler, who writes for Counterpunch from time to time, and he's at, I forgot what think tank, or rather now National Priorities Project or something, and he's been picking on the F-35 and the F-22 both for a long time, and I saw in a comment section where they were accusing him of being a double secret agent of Lockheed, sent here to undermine confidence in their product because they're going to get the contract for the next plane too, and they make way more money during development than they do during the mass production. So they just go ahead and aim to fail.
Yep, they don't have as much. They don't have to pay for any of the overhead or the actual parts and stuff, or as much during development as they do with actually produce the things on the line. So, I'm sure that's where they make more profit. But anyway, well, thanks for the great show, Scott, and hey, I'll talk to you later. Thanks,
appreciate it. Thanks for calling in. Yeah, they face the profit test, but never the loss test. Over there at Lockheed, they've got the exact same set of financial priorities as the government does. Waste as much as you can, fail as poorly as you possibly can, and then that way you get more money and more power to do worse later. It's perfect. It's just exactly the opposite of the incentives of the marketplace. In fact, I think I talked with you guys a little bit. I didn't interview him about it, but I mentioned to you about Andrew Coburn's article in Harper's Magazine from a few months back, where he talked about how Boeing, you know, they make, 757s and whatever, they make all kinds of passenger airlines, but they've been focusing so much on military equipment that they have structured their entire corporation and its entire manufacturing process around militarism and around the methods used to best secure the highest profits from the Pentagon, which is an entirely different setup than in the capitalist market. So what happens is, for example, and this is something that I'm actually very pleased to believe now that everybody's heard of this. This is no longer kind of a, oh man, well, I didn't know that kind of thing. This is a thing everybody knows now, right? That the military industrial firms will have little bitty pieces of every one of their weapons systems made in different congressional districts all across the country, in as many of them as they possibly can. And in fact, I think I read somewhere, some expert said on the show that in the case of the F-35, they literally have something to do with it in all 435 congressional districts in America or something. Is that right? Or really close, anyway. Because that's how to make sure you get your contract, is you can go to any given congressman and say, blam, I will turn this entire company's workforce against you for taking their jobs away and threaten you politically so that they will stay on board for all of this madness. Well, so it turns out when they were making the 777 for commercial use, they went on that same method, on that same structure of their company. And they ended up outsourcing as many little pieces, not just of the actual construction, but even of the engineering of the plane in the first place. They outsourced every little bit of the project to as many places as they could just to try to blackmail Congress into not to Congress just because that's their method. That's how they had created their company. Sorry, Space Al, I was thinking about how I just blew my break 10 minutes ago. I'm really bad at that, blowing all my breaks. And so they end up making a plane that's a piece of crap. That's the point. If Boeing was not a military contractor, they just made planes for the private market, they would have it set up entirely different. And the quality controls, for example, would be much tighter, would take much higher priority in their process than just making sure that parts are made in as many different places as possible, which makes no sense when you're talking about selling a plane to a private company, which is not represented by congressmen and doesn't care about that. But it's just that the structure of the company is already shaped that way. And so that's why the 777 has plastic wings. It's a piece of crap. Or at least it's got, you know, where the wings meet the body. It's not up to snuff there. That's why the batteries are on fire. And that's why the thing's a piece of garbage. Read Andrew Coburn and Harper's. Anyway, hey, I'm Scott. You're on the air. Wait, before you say anything, the number's 512-271-4836 or 877-513-0792. 877-513-0792. Okay, now you're on. How's it going? Oh, wait, I didn't hit the button yet, did I? Here, I'm hitting the button now. There you go.
Hey, Scott. Hey, Scott, it's Corky. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Hey, I'm standing down here. This is a little bit off topic, but it has a lot to do with a lot of what you talk about government wastefulness. Standing down here on a nice day, ground zero, Hurricane Sandy in New Jersey, and not jack squat has been done here. It's unbelievable how it could be almost a year later, and the dunes are non-existent. We have no protection down here, and we got a governor who likes to just sit on the boardwalk and eat cheesesteaks and dribble them all over himself talking about how great we are.
Yeah, I don't know what it is with that guy. I don't know that much about him, but he sure seems like a chump to me. But then I guess that's how he got the job. But now, so is this the same? Is this just in your neighborhood there on the Jersey Shore? Or this is all up and down all over the place? There's just nothing being done or what?
Sandy Hook down to Cape May, basically nothing has been done except by the local municipalities trying to shore up some really bad spots with seawalls and stuff. But it's flat here. It's like I've never seen before. I've never seen the beaches so small in my life. And I just think about all this money that's pissed away by the government. And, you know, they could really do something here that would really affect a lot of people. And there's all they do is talk. They talk and they do nothing.
Well, I wonder, is it a crime for you to try to go around them and see if you can raise enough money to import some sand from somewhere and get it done yourself?
The towns aren't going to do it. They're going to wait for the feds, or they're going to wait for the other sources of funding. Hey, a lot of these towns, their tax bases are way down.
Sure.
And they don't have the money. I mean, our taxes are all going to go up as a result of this, because a lot of people have just said, I'm out of here.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's expensive to afford all those tanks and machine guns that their SWAT teams need to enforce the local cocaine possession laws and whatever other nonsense. So, got to have your priorities, right? It's just like Chief Wiggum says on The Simpsons, we're powerless to help you, not to harm you.
Right. But that's, I mean, it just kind of wraps around with everything you talk about, with the wastefulness and the military spending, and that there are legitimate causes within this country where we really should be trying to help people out, especially people who don't have any food or, you know, things that where they're just so in bad shape that we should be trying to help them. And I'm not a liberal. You know me. I'm sort of like a you know, I don't know what I am now.
Well, listen, I mean, you make a great point about, you know, the basis. I think that, look, what you're saying now, you're speaking for 300 million Americans, basically. If there's going to be a government at all, I thought you guys said that the reason that we love you is because you're here to take care of us in case there's a storm. You're here to take care of us in case there's an impending hijacking terrorist attack. You're here to prevent these bad things from happening. Somebody wants to blow up a marathon or something like that. And instead, what do? You know, their roads kill 30,000 people a year. The hurricanes come, and they don't do a damn thing about it. I mean, look at, you think you got it bad. Look at New Orleans, where the government had a monopoly on preventing the building up of natural dikes, and instead saying, no, the Army Corps of Engineers, we know what to do. We're going to build this irrigation system that then completely fails and drowns 2,000, 3,000 people to death. I mean, if you and I say, look, you know what, we don't need them at all, what's our neighbors, never mind the government, never mind Chris Christie and his PR men, what do the people say? The people say, but we need FEMA for when there's terrible natural disasters, and we need the Department of Transportation so that we can get to and fro. But they don't have any, they don't do a good job at this if they do their job at all.
Yeah, FEMA is useless. I mean, in the case here, all they did was come up with some ridiculous calculations on elevation, told people that their insurance had to go up 6 or 7 times. And basically what they're doing is they're causing a whole generation of people to move away from here because of their stupidity. And, you know, there's groups here fighting them. But it seems like, you know, FEMA's got an endless supply of cash to fight back. And that's our money, and that's what's so frustrating. It's like they're using our own weapons against us. In this case, it's the financial, you know, the tax base.
Yep. Well, and that's the way it's going to stay, too. Sorry to say.
Well, that's my report from the shore, Scott. You know, you got a great show, and I hope for the best for you, man. And say hello to your wife, and maybe you can interview her someday, because she's a pretty interesting person, too. She might be more interesting than you.
Yeah, she certainly is. That's why I keep her in the back room, because I'm afraid that what's going to happen is you guys are just going to want this to be the Larissa Alexandrovna show now. I bring her on.
Yeah, that's right. You'll be Ed McMahon instead of Johnny Carson, man.
Exactly. I'm a very jealous man.
Hey, good talking to you.
You too, man. Thanks for calling in. Appreciate it. He's right. You know, my wife is awesome. And in fact, today's our 2-year anniversary. Not really our wedding anniversary. Or 3-year. Wait, what year is it? Yeah, our 3-year anniversary. Not of our wedding, but of getting together anyway. It was 3 years ago. I went to Florida to scoop her ass up and bring her out to L.A. with me. So, happy anniversary, sweetheart. All right, anybody else wants to call on the show? It's 512-271-4836, 512-271-4836, or 877-513-0792, 877-513-0792. Now, we got JSOC in 120 countries, mostly just killing people in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, probably down in Libya and Mali. You want to talk about any of those wars, that's fine. CIA stuff, Guantanamo Bay, National Security Agency tapping your line. You know, there's been a steady stream of this NSA stuff coming forward, and I think a lot of people have probably missed. Did I give the number again? 512-271-4836, 877-513-0792, if anybody wants to call in the line there. Now, you may have missed this. There's kind of a steady trickle of National Security Agency stuff coming out, and so it all sort of blends together, kind of. But no, this is huge, man. James Risen and Laura Poitras at the New York Times now involved. Poitras, of course, has been in on it from the beginning, but they've now decided to bring in the New York Times on reporting the Edward Snowden leaks. And this one is called NSA Gathers Data on Social Connections of U.S. Citizens. And this is basically your worst nightmare about what they were doing. Basically building a dossier on the whole country. And who is all tied to who and by how many hops. And who were you with on the 4th of July? And whose car did you ride in to get there? And who did you send a tweet to about it? And everything else, I guess. Oh, just as long as you know somebody who's a foreigner. Or just as long as you know somebody who knows somebody who's a foreigner. So in other words, all 300 million of us. NSA gathers data on social connections of U.S. citizens. And you know, I'm sorry, because I'm just not technical enough to really wrap my head around all of the detail-y details here, but more or less what I'm imagining is what Christopher Ketchum wrote about when he wrote his piece on Maine Corps for Counterpunch back a few years ago, and this was more for Homeland Security and FBI, but it's, I guess, along the lines of the very same thing. You type in, you know, Dave, the webmaster, and then you hit enter. And then it pulls up everything on Dave instantly. So you don't really need his FBI file, so to speak. It's every piece of data about Dave in the world, or as much of it as absolutely possible, the U.S. government has access to, can grab it, and can assemble it on a page in front of a Fed in a moment. So there's all your scores in kindergarten, and there's all your health records, and there's every address and phone number you've ever had and bill you've ever paid, and every time you ever bought a cheeseburger on your debit card, and everything. It's all there. Where you were when you did so. And of course, all your telephone metadata, which includes all your GPS and your triangulation data. So in other words, if they really wanted to know about Dave, they can type in Dave and presumably they can go back and recreate his life on a day-to-day basis, at least his phone's life. And in fact, probably even do a pretty good job of resolving discrepancies between some of his behavior and his telephone's location at any given time, if there's any discrepancies there. This is what they're doing to us. Now remember, again, at the time of September 11th, Al-Qaeda was 200 or 300 guys. More than two-thirds of them destroyed by the U.S. Air Force and the CIA with their laser designators in the fall of 2001. It was just a couple of few dozen. I think the highest estimate I've ever seen was 80 guys escaped with bin Laden and Zawahiri to Pakistan. There's a clip, I can't find it anymore, but I did find it one time on YouTube, of Zawahiri mocking the Americans for being so afraid, for having the entire group, what was left of our enemies, cornered in 1 square mile at Tora Bora. And then Tommy Franks, instead of blasting them off the face of the earth, instead of sending in the Marines, no matter how many had to die to do it, instead of getting the job done, what did he do? He had George Tenet hire Gulbuddin Hekmatyar to go and finish off Osama for us. Well, Hekmatyar took the cash and then helped Osama escape. And then bragged about it in the Pakistani press. Ha, yeah, those CIA guys, they're idiots. I took all their money and then I helped Osama escape. He's now part of the Karzai government that America backs and pays. Anyway, those were our enemies. 200 or 300 guys. But this is why they have to data mine everything about you. And by the way, as somebody smart was saying on the Twitter the other day, you know, they brought up the clipper chip thing back in the 1990s, and the people said no. And then it leaked about total information awareness in 2002. And people said no. There's a line. You're crossing it. Stop. And then, as listeners to this show for years have known, they simply moved TIA over to the National Security Agency and renamed it Basketball. It's under some different names now, but anybody who's familiar with James Bamford's reporting knows all about that. But the point being that the democracy and the rule of law and the Congress and all these wonderful things that we're supposed to worship and respect as the basis of the legitimacy of this state, they all said, no, you can't do that. No, you cannot data mine my cousin under the excuse that you accidentally let Osama escape back at Tora Bora. Go data mine Osama and leave me and my cousin alone. What the hell are you doing? How in the world are they data mining us under the excuse of the Al-Qaeda movement now, which you got to admit includes a few thousand guys? If you count all the Mujahideen we're backing in Syria, includes maybe as many as 5,000 or 10,000 guys at this point, because our government is led by the worst of traitors who back the only enemies the American people have. And of course, their whole policy has done nothing but swell the ranks of their enemies from 80 to 10,000 this whole time, especially with the war in Iraq, and now especially the war in Iraq, which accidentally benefited Al-Qaeda to the greatest degree, but especially the wars in Libya and Syria, which America's fought directly on their behalf. Are you kidding me? But now, under the excuse of protecting us from the Mujahideen that our government is supporting in Syria right now, they're keeping track of you and your Facebook friends. And who's Facebook friends with who. And I got to tell you, folks, there's a big difference. Hell, you could tell me, right? There's a big difference between data and knowledge. It's a big difference between a bunch of ones and zeros and a human brain making sense of something. And especially actually getting it right. Because you know what? I've got links to who knows what. You want to talk about links? You want to talk about Google search terms I've ever looked at? You want to talk about two hops away? I one time from my office phone, one time nothing, a few times, I've talked to generals and former generals in Pakistan. I've numerous times talked to, you know, journalists all over the old world. And so at least some of those conversations were certainly intercepted by the National Security Agency. But so then what does that mean? Everybody in my cell phone is now, they're all up for grabs too, their entire lives. And now everybody that they have a relationship and everybody that those people have relationships with. Who was it that did the math? I think it was the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the EFF guys. Or was it the ACLU? Hell, I can't remember my footnote anymore. But somebody did the math and said, if you really took all the people who are tied to who you say you got to be investigated, and then you went three hops from there, that's more than the entire population of the world. So it certainly includes everybody in America who's on the grid at all, I guess. I saw this great thing. I tried to find it Googling around the other day, and I couldn't find it. But I saw a great thing one time on the Science Channel. I don't think I have that here in Austin. I had it in L.A. They got kind of an orange logo, I guess. I saw a really cool thing on M-Theory on there, too, once. But anyway, they had this thing about network science. And it was about how, actually, this is sort of kind of brand new. And it actually started with the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon and how every actor is tied to Kevin Bacon and how some mathematicians finally figured out that actually everyone in the world is just 6 steps from Kevin Bacon. Turns out everyone in the world is just 6 steps from each other. And there are some exceptions if you go way out to deepest, darkest something or other or whatever. But for the most part, everybody's tied together this way. And they figured out some pretty nifty things about, you know, the form of relationship patterns with their math. And then they used this to help fight the war in Iraq, especially, and I guess supposedly under the surge in Afghanistan, too. Mostly as Gareth Porter reported, with cell phone data. Who's tied to who? How many hops away? And if this guy ever called this guy, ever killed this guy, ever called that guy, ever killed this guy, then we need to send the Delta Force out to scoop him up. And to them, if you hear them tell it, they'll say, oh, it's so reliable, and we got everything figured out, and we're so smart, and whatever. But to me, what it sounds like is the lowest form of probable cause you could imagine. The lowest form of articulatable suspicion. Well, this guy's phone called this guy's phone called this guy's phone called this guy's phone. So, blow them up. Wow, man, you don't know what that means. You know what I mean? It's you're basically outsourcing thinking to a computer, and you're letting a computer readout add a bunch of import, you know, in your imagination, basically, where the facts won't take you. It's a conspiracy theory machine. That's what it is, all this data mining. It's, you know, that's what intelligence is. Accusation levied by a government agent against someone, right? That's intelligence. Well, same thing for something that they read off of a screen somewhere. Well, you can count on it because it says here. So, in other words, garbage in, garbage out, innocent people hurt, right? Obviously. That's how it works. NSA social graphing. Oh yeah, I guess one more thing that's worth bringing up about the NSA thing too is that Scahill, they've announced that Scahill is going to be working with Greenwald on the NSA's role in the JSOC global assassination program. So that should be fun, huh? Yeah. All right. See y'all tomorrow. Not on No Agenda, but at scotthorton.org/listen. Same bat time and all.